shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here.
Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Shooting From The Lip on Sputnik International with me, John Gaunt. There is so much again to talk about. I'm delighted to say I've got a great guest who can really shoot from the lip this week. It's Mr. Johnny Gould from Johnny Gould's Jewish State Podcast.
Shooting From The Lip.
Good afternoon, Johnny.
John, always a pleasure to join you.
All right, let's crack on. Breaking news today, of course, is that Keir Starmer and the Labour Party have apologised to the whistleblowers on the anti-Semitism issue and are offering substantial damages. Too little, too late, or do you welcome this?
No, we've got to welcome it. And as the person who personally introduced John Ware, the Panorama reporter, to Mark Lewis, the lawyer behind all these many cases, I feel it's a vindication of John's proper, methodical journalism. And, you know, I interviewed him in the days after his programme, Is Labour Anti-Semitic, aired on BBC One just over a year ago. And he was very composed, very measured. He said he was ready for the onslaught. He felt confident. And more fool Labour for the way that they reacted to it and still tried to stop it. There's even talk that with the EHRC investigation, which is due for its launch and announcement by the Labour Party and their actions to rectify issues on August the 3rd, that week beginning, that actually he may have the whip withdrawn. So, you know, there'll be 500,000 cheerleaders for him in his sorry retirement, but he will bow out of politics, I think, in disgrace.
Well, you say in disgrace. He's come out fighting today, Mr. Corbyn. He's not happy at all. But is this at the end of Corbyn's version of the Labour Party?
Yeah, that's all he's got. You know, you may as well fight. He'll believe what he believes till his dying day. I mean, he was outside Archway Station barking about Black Lives Matter, and there was an awful lot of clapping for what he was saying. You know, I don't deny that he's entitled to his free speech, just as we are to counter him. And there was a big round of applause, and the video panned around the people there. There were 68 people there. He's no longer a power, but he does have his column of support, but they were resoundingly defeated at the December 2019 election. And I don't think Britain has an appetite in the mainstream. When I say the mainstream, I mean the people who voted against him and who don't like his version of the Labour Party. They don't want a bar of that in Britain. I think Britain is better than this.
I agree totally. Do you think it has damaged the Labour Party? Can Keir Starmer bring it back? Because, of course, Boris is getting battered from every single side. So where do you think the Labour Party are going to go now?
You know, Labour's defeat was so heavy in December 2019, it would be quite a political avalanche if they could turn it round to a victory in just one election. So perhaps what might happen is that the Tories might win the next election. It's very, very early to say this, but some of the red wall might be resurrected again in unlikely places where the Tories won, like Redcar and Sedgefield and various other places in perhaps the Nottinghamshire constituencies and in the West Midlands as well, as Boris's promises to equalise the economy don't really come to fruition that fast. I think the Tories have a tremendous asset, though, now, and that is Mr. Rishi Sunak, who is giving out money like he's printing it. Maybe he will print it.
The only problem is, Johnny, yeah, there's a day of reckoning coming there. And I think that all bets are off in terms of the future of politics in this country, indeed around the globe with Trump and Biden, because coronavirus, COVID-19, is dominating everything, isn't it?
So far, aftermath, the macroeconomic aftermath of what will come from this that is so interesting. I mean, you know, we're still living with the massive upheaval that the credit crunch of the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009 allowed, and that is that it created free money and a free pass for millionaires to become billionaires. And I mean, anyone that was a property owner, whether they be the most humble 35-year-old of the time, has all the money at the expense of their children who have nothing but McJobs and can't get a mortgage. So, you know, that is the basic premise of what happened to Britain. And I fear that though there is a very statist response, in other words, the state will become much bigger and much more powerful in our private lives after the coronavirus, as they have in the last 4 months, certainly, I do worry that actually it stops mobility. You know, that in reality, you know, you are where you are now. That's your lot. It will be more difficult for people to increase their mobility unless they're very, very lucky. I think, you know, if people are serious about mobility and if the government is serious about mobility, they have to get out the way a little bit and allow us to sort of live our lives. Otherwise, all these statist polities which look after everybody will only sort of keep people in their positions. And I'm not sure that's very healthy.
Well, there's already talk about that, isn't there, in terms of education, that working class kids are probably not being getting the same level of homeschooling. And we're in this ridiculous situation, in my opinion, where pubs are open, nail bars are open, but our schools aren't. What do you make of that?
I've got this issue because luckily they decided at the school that I send my little girl to that they would open it up for her, which is the four-year-old class, the 4 and 5-year-old class, because obviously they're beginning the rudimentaries of reading and writing and arithmetic, and the year six, the kids who are about to go to secondary school, because they viewed those as the most critical years to take part. And they opened the school 3 of the 5 days a week, and we all had to social distance this and wear masks that. But I'm extremely grateful, I have to say, even though they were at 60% of their power. And I feel very sorry for the parents who are in the year above, or year three, year four, etc., whose kids will be stuck at home until September. And even then, John, we don't know whether people are coming back. You know, homeschooling was tough. You know, we did our best with the kids. And actually, my little girl's writing improved. It must be like a sort of miracle thing. But, you know, she just got better at it. But that's not the point. The point is they need professional education. And she benefited from the dynamic of the class much more than silly old Mrs. Daddy, who has no experience at all at teaching.
What do you think about the situation where he's now rewarded teachers and frontline nursing staff, but not care home workers? They're all getting a massive, well, not a massive, they're getting a pay rise. Do you applaud that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we've had 10 years of people's wages being stagnant. And I think if we're going to operate in a public sector environment to motivate the country a little bit, the boss has to give out a stick of rock to people. It has to give people a motivation and a little bit of a pay rise here and there to everyone in the public sector. However, he generates that through either taxation or, you know, quantitative easing, which is the trendy word of the noughties and tens, wasn't it?
Well, that's printing money, isn't it, basically?
Basically, yes. I mean, we're going to have to do that. If you've got millions and millions of people on the government payroll, we're going to have to incentivize them out, us all, out of this mire. We've got to give people meaningful jobs with meaningful salaries.
Are you surprised how compliant the British public have been? And now, since lockdown's lifting, the fact that London and major cities are ghost towns, people don't seem to want to go back to work.
Yeah, because I think if you give out too many grants, it's a great disincentive to get off your bum, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the issues. And at some point, Rishi Sunak is going to have to stop it cold and clean. The problem with that is we're going to have a bit of mass unemployment. In other Western economies, there is 28, 30% unemployment because they haven't had the parachute, the welfare that we've enjoyed in this country, thanks to Rishi Sunak. But unfortunately, he is kicking the can into the future. There has to be an economic reality in a capitalist economy. And regrettably, there will be very, very big unemployment. We've seen sort of big, big companies either go to the wall or, you know, lose, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands and thousands of jobs. Even successful businesses like Marks and Spencer's Simply Food, all the management is being taken out. 1,500, 2,000 jobs are being lost there. And that's a good business. It's going well for M&S. So, and also we've seen the end of Boeing 747. I don't know, you know, we talk about artificial intelligence and the workplace changing over the next 15 years and some of the changes being hastened by this sudden left of center attack from COVID. So maybe some good will come out of this, but my goodness, there are going to be some shocks and some really upsetting things happening in the meantime to get there.
Do you think people then, it's about sort of comfort at the moment, they've got the furlough money or whatever, and they need that kick up the bum, or isn't fear part of it? They really played the Operation Fear, and now people are just scared to go out, or do you not buy into that?
Yeah, old people particularly, when I say old people, I mean people of the generation of 75 and over. I've talked to many people, and they are scared to go out, and I feel sad for them. My mum is obviously over 70, but she's come to the conclusion that, you know, life is to be lived, and she's got neighbours who haven't been out their house for 4 months. I talked to my friend Ronnie, who's 80 years old. He made his first visit to the town centre to go to the bank in 4 months, and I think that's a very sorry end to the autumn of your life. I think we should try to live our lives, and if it makes you feel better, put a mask on, you know, and keep your distance from people. But I think it's really hit the hit the old in terms of fear disproportionately, because I think they're scared of the media in the way that you and me, John, aren't. I think that, you know, we both see through it because we used to be in it.
Okay, so just answer me this question then. Yeah, I understand that. So come Friday, are you going to be wearing a mask?
If I'm told to, yeah. I mean, I'd try and be a sort of a courteous member of the public. I don't really particularly believe in it. I believe in if you keep your distance, that's probably most of the issue. That's very difficult in Tesco because, you know, I've noticed how people who fill the shelves, they don't seem to care very much about...
I noticed that. I was in Sainsbury's today and I noticed that completely. Most people had masks on, but none of the assistants filling the shelves did. Quite odd, isn't it?
I suppose they think, well, I'm being surrounded by thousands of people anyway. I've probably got it already anyway. And that's the kind of view they take. But of course, for us, it's scary. Yeah, look, I am going to wear a mask. I don't particularly agree with it. I'm going to show courtesy to people who genuinely are scared. But you know, there's two illnesses, aren't there, John? There's the real COVID, there's the real death, and there's the real hospitalisation, and there's the media version sponsored by Piers Morgan and that awful doctor.
Explain to me what you mean by that. You think people like Piers Morgan and Hillary, whatever his name is, they've stirred it up, do you? They've stirred up the fear. And have they stirred up the fear more than Boris?
Definitely. I don't want to be too critical of Hillary Jones as a journalist, but, you know, 80% of his advice is about medical and 20% of it is about lifestyle, sort of talking about where you can go in the car, where you can go to parks locally. Oi, get lost. That's issues of liberty and freedom. Talk about lungs, please. Talk about the effect it has on, you know, temperatures. You know, if it's 25 Celsius, we were told that, you know, if you put a COVID virus in the midday sun in the summer, it evaporates in 15 minutes. I want to hear the medical side. I don't want him to be an acolyte because he's scared of being told off by Morgan. I'm very, very happy for the sanity of the country has been taken off air for the summer.
OK, let's talk about Piers Morgan for a moment then. He says he wants to hold them to account. Government ministers have now blacked the show, if I can still use that term. They're not willing to go on. Who's right in this then?
Look, it's his job to be a pain in the rump, isn't it? That's his job. But, you know, there is journalism in which you can scrutinise without trying to catch ministers out who are incidentally media trained and designed to be slippery and answer the question in a way that they want to rather than Morgan asks. And so we get to this impasse where there'll be no Tory who wants to go on, and it'll become the it'll become the message board of the opposition. I think we need to engage a little bit more. You know, we've got Kate Garraway on, who is the very real end of this disease because of poor old Derek Draper, her husband, who, you know, thank goodness, I don't think he's gravely ill anymore, but who knows where this illness will end for him.
But when you talk or allude to that sort of gotcha journalism, it isn't just Piers Morgan. In those dreadful press conferences, lots of the journalists were trying to do that. Laura Kuzenberg, people like Kay Burley, in my opinion, not Kay Burley, Beth Rigby, in my opinion, were doing the same. We weren't getting informed. And to be honest, when they pulled them, I just thought, thank God, the Chuckle Brothers are witty and Valance are boring me to death. I'd rather die than watch another one of these.
Yes, I'm glad they pulled them. I mean, the complaint was at the beginning of the crisis that the government had gone into hiding, so they all decided that they should have a daily conference at 5 p.m, which was a free party political broadcast on behalf of the Conservative Party. It became like that. And then we had, you know, Peston being wheeled in on a television with a wire. It looked like Max Headroom, you know, asking the questions there. From his London home. I mean, you honestly, you'd give up watching it. But Sky News seem to be televising the Nicola Sturgeon news conference every day. I can't imagine anyone would be watching that after 7 or 10 minutes.
Leave it there for a second. That is the voice of Johnny Gould, and he's definitely shooting from the lip. We'll talk a bit more about clarity, how poor Boris has handled the pandemic, straight after this short break. We're going to talk about Shamia Begum and whether she should combat the so-called jihadi bride. We are going to talk about China, the Russia report as well, and Brexit. All coming up after this short break. Don't dare go away.
Shooting from the lip.
Hi, welcome back to the second half of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt. And we've still got loads to talk about. If you want to join in, you can send me an email afterwards and we'll certainly discuss what you have to say. Let's just go back to you, Johnny, if we can. Do you think Boris has had a good pandemic?
I love that. That was like a Jeff Stelling question post-match. Well, second half, he played a blinder, but first half, you know, he's come back from that injury, you know. Seriously, in all seriousness, I mean, Boris, let's not forget, was very, very ill. And, you know, here was a guy who, you know, 55 years old, a full pelt, fit lad, strong as an ox. I think he took his health for granted and he ended up in intensive care. Who knows what long-term that's done to him? We talk about COVID having long-term effects on people who've been great sufferers of it. I don't think any government has come out of this with sailing colours. I mean, you know, we're just human beings and we're responding to a pandemic, which I voted for him. I'll make no bones about it, or at least I voted for the local Tory. And of course, I lost being in London, in a London constituency, of course. In fact, you know who my MP is, John? It's Keir Starmer.
Oh, good old you.
He's not very accountable, is he?
No. Just answer me a question then. Did you agree with lockdown? And did you think it was too early or too late? I thought it was too late. I thought the Cheltenham Festival should have been cancelled, and indeed that match. And I'm not saying this with hindsight. I said it at the time. What about you?
Yes, we all worried about the Cheltenham Festival, and I thought they were extremely cavalier. And that's got nothing to do with the horses running around. They should not. And it was all in view. And I had an appointment, which was a lunch with some clients just before it. And we all knew that we shouldn't really be doing this. And yes, they should have locked down early. It was the right thing to do. I think it's gone on a bit too far because, like any war, and this is comparable to a war, it's easy to start one. How do you finish it? And, you know, it's got into people's psyche. And as I mentioned, old people. Can I talk about London, John? Because I have had the fortune of traveling around the country during this pandemic, not in a Castle Barnard eyesight kind of way, a bit later on when it was allowed. But I've been traveling down to Eastbourne, which has a population of 170,000. It relies quite a lot on tourism, not entirely. It's still a town of its own volition, quite a big town. People don't really know that. But it's 170,000 population. And there are villages around it, like, for example, East Dean. And what I noticed was that in London, the traffic has returned not exactly to normal and the shops aren't exactly open again, but people are trying. The footfall is down radically from what you'd expect of a normal sort of London summer with no tourists, etc. But the smaller the town, the more gravely hit the economy is. In Eastbourne, no word of an exaggeration, I went through a deserted town centre at 5:30 on a Saturday afternoon, and because the council gardeners hadn't really attended to the sort of public gardens, there was literally tumbleweed flying through the precincts because some of the shrubbery had come up and it was dead and it was being blown through the town. And I took a photo of the tumbleweed. I decided not to upload it because I didn't want Eastbourne to have any damage from it. It was a metaphoric shock. And the smaller you get, then I went to a village called East Dean, which was built in 1086. It was the first Norman settlement. It's on the mountaintop at Beachy Head. And it has a pub, which is 1,000 years old. It has a rectory, which has a blue plaque. And this is typical England. It says Sherlock Holmes. You know, I love that, the idea of a fictional character actually retiring to that place. It was so closed. They put the barriers up and I couldn't see anyone walking around. It made me extremely sad. And basically what I'm saying is the smaller the town, the smaller the village, the more economic damage it's done to that community. In London, you don't notice quite as much, even though it is apparent. But that's what I'm sorry about, that we're making legislation here in London, in the bubble. And, you know, what about Wolverhampton? What about Eastbourne? What about Ipswich? You know, what about a great Fakenham, you know?
I agree with you entirely. Similar things happening in Warwick, where I live at the moment. They've made a one-way system for the cars so that there's more pavement room. But the problem is no one's coming in because they think everything's closed and shops are going bust left, right and centre. I want to bring you back to sport, to football and to Formula One. Many people know you as a great sports broadcaster. What do you make of the BLM issue, the lads wearing BLM on the back of their shirts, taking the knee? Do you think that's been a good move, or do you think the FA or whoever's in charge of football, I suppose it's McDonald's, were too quick to jump on this whole political movement? Your views?
They did no due diligence on what Black Lives Matter stood for. We all agree that with a small b, small l and small m, Black Lives Matter, just as any old life matters. Any life is precious, any life is sacred. But Black Lives Matter on their charge sheet also want to defund capitalism. And they want to defund the police. They want to legalize drugs and they want to create a free Palestine, which would precipitate a Holocaust in the Middle East. Presumably, they would allow Palestinians in there to create some sort of civil disturbance and war, which Israel would fight back with. They have no idea or concept of what anti-Zionism truly stands for. And that's my definition of anti-Zionism. So you can't just pick and choose. Richard Masters, the chief exec, when he discovered this, went, I don't really agree with those things. And Keir Starmer said the same thing. Now, I mean, if you wore a swastika in Germany in 1943, you couldn't stand for Hitler, but not for his extermination of minority, of the Jewish people, or the Gypsies, or Poles, or whatever. You stood for the whole lot. You can't pick and choose. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that the reason why English football, and I say English football as the birthplace of the game, has produced such massive syndication and such worldwide popularity, probably more than it would have been successful if it had come from any other country, is that we syndicated a sport of endeavor, of merit, okay? It was a clean skin. It's not policy orientated. So you only have to go to Glasgow. You only have to go over the border to see what politics does to football. And you think about Glasgow, it is totally sectarian. Do you know a Catholic Rangers supporter? What a tragedy. Do you know a Protestant Celtic one? What an absolute tragedy that one doesn't know that and that you have to be born into it. And then you look at Liverpool, right? Liverpool and Glasgow are similar in many, many ways. Okay, but there's nothing sectarian about Liverpool and Everton. Okay, families all get upset with each other after one team's beaten the other 2-0, usually the team in red. But, you know, that's all it is. That, you know, Protestants marry Catholics, you know, Evertonians are everything. You know, it's all good.
I think that's a very good point you're making. I want to move through these subjects quite quickly now. Let's talk about Lewis Hamilton. He's obviously leading the BLM movement in Formula One. He's had a go today at Andretti and at Jackie Stewart because Andretti described him as a militant. What do you make of that?
I stand with Andretti, hashtag. I mean, really, if there's anyone who represents the elite more than Lewis Hamilton, I can't think of it. You know, he's a tax exile. He lives in Monaco. He drives a Mercedes. Let's look back 75 years to see what their track record is on slavery. Thanks very much. Do people who support BLM really care about making change? Really care? You know, if Andretti and Jackie Stewart want to say that about motor racing in a similar way I'm imagining to how I feel about football, which is that football is apolitical, then let them do that. Because change can never come, you know, when corporate establishments get on board. And unfortunately, Hamilton is one of those people.
Okay, good points. Let's talk about Shamima Begum. Should she be allowed back to have this appeal? I was disgusted by it. Your views?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, once you get her back, and by the way, Colonel Richard Kemp made a very important point. Who are the soldiers who are going to try and get her back? Can you imagine trying to get her out of wherever she is? I mean, really? British soldiers going in there, risking their lives to get her out?
Is she a British citizen as far as you're concerned?
Well, she hasn't been stripped of it yet, so technically I guess she is. But my point is this. When and if you get her back and you judge against her that she should be found guilty of high treason and that she should be allowed or she must now leave the country, how actually are we ever going to allow that?
Oh, if she comes back, she'll never go back, Johnny.
Exactly. She'll be in our prison system and she will be an inspiration, an icon for those who wish the worst wish a jihad upon us here. So, and another thing, you know, I don't like to virtue signal. I try not to do that. But I did go to Geneva and meet and interview Farida Abbas Khalaf. And she was the Yazidi sex slave whose family were murdered. And she was sold into slavery because she came from the northern Iraqi village of Sinjar. And now, luckily, thank goodness, she got married and lives peacefully in Cologne in Germany. And their elders, their priests, basically said to the Yazidi men that these women, though they had been defiled and raped and treated with the worst possible disrespect that you could to a woman, they should be treated with the highest respect by Yazidi men and that their integrity remained intact. And I think that's the greatest blessing that you can give to a female victim in war. And she got married and she lives a happy life as much as you can after the torment she went through.
Yeah, again, a brilliant point. Got to finish in a moment. Let's talk about China, because what do you make of what's happening in China at the moment with those Muslims?
we have been warned. I mean, we can't say we've not been warned. There are pictures of people with blindfolds on in a queue waiting for a train. Recognize that from history, anyone?
Why aren't we dealing with it then? Because at the moment it seems as if the government wants to make the Russians the enemy. You know, we've all got a red under the bed, if you believe the Russia report yesterday. But surely it's China that we should be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'm so shocked about is that China have spent the last 20 years economically embedding themselves around the world, giving out free loans and free infrastructural investments on very favorable terms. And then when the country defaults, they then take control of the poor on the condition that. And so they are conditional. And the thing that I am very, very upset with, I'll use Israel as an example. Israel, Norway, and Canada were one of only a few countries who successfully navigated the credit crunch because they don't have the same resources or they understood the interconnected world could cause hazard. Apparently, since then, Israel has been developing ports up and down its small coastline in conjunction with the Chinese. During lockdown, Mike Pompeo from the Trump administration went to see Benjamin Netanyahu to warn them about China and to disengage as much as they possibly could. For a country like Israel to have been involved here, we know this country too, in Britain, you know, they own our water, you know, they have a significant exchange in our electricity.
Well, and they nearly got 5G and they've certainly got a lot of 4G already, yes.
We are being forced to buy their silence diplomatically over such issues as slavery in the UN. Nick Timothy, I spoke to him on the podcast last month, and he's been warning about this for the last 10 years. And when he reported back to cabinet ministers and to the government, they said things like, well, they're going to roger us anyway. We may as well take the money. That's literally what was coming out of the mouth of our politicians. So now the moment of reckoning has come, John.
Sure. And for people who don't know, Nick Timothy was, of course, the advisor to Theresa May. Johnny, that has been a brilliant half an hour. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Johnny Gould from the Johnny Gould's Jewish State podcast. He was certainly shooting from the lip. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.
Shooting from the lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.